This is edition number 2019 of The Mardler, recorded at Aylsham on Friday the 29th of May, 2026. Hello and a warm welcome to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper. Just two items for the notice board this week. The sun rises at around 4:30 in the morning and sets at around 9:00 in the evening. And the Mardler Annual General Meeting will be held on Saturday the 6th of June in the Methodist Hall, 26 White Hart Street, Aylsham, NR11 6HG. Tea, coffee and biscuits will be served from 10 a.m, with the meeting starting at 10:30. All Mardler listeners and volunteers are welcome. Our week's news and views are from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 28th of May. I am Chris Lodes and my fellow readers are
Robert Watton,
Sue Hill
and Claire Hill.
The magazine supplement, which includes How the Norfolk Broads Can Change Lives, Building the Prehistoric Way, Solhouse and Clyne Marshes Making History, and Why You Should Avoid the News, follow later. But first, villages in fight bid to turn barn into boutique hotel. Droughts could hit food production unless action is taken to reclaim the rain. More than 30 Norfolk fire stations short of on-call crew to respond to emergencies. However, we lead with 81-year-old woman kept waiting nearly 3 years for back pain treatment. An 81-year-old woman struggling with debilitating back pain has been waiting nearly 3 years for treatment. Leslie Cook from Holt is fighting for more to be done after her back pain continues to go untreated, leaving her struggling just to walk. It was in January 2023 when she first woke up with a backache. After feeling the pain get worse, despite her own attempts to settle it, she was referred to Cromer Hospital in August that year. She had an x-ray in September, and following the result, she paid for 3 sessions with a physio, but it didn't help. That is when she was sent to the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital and was told that she was too old for surgery. Instead, they said they could try steroid injections, but warned her they may not work. She booked a private consultation at Spire, which cost £500, but she could not afford the cost of the private injections, so she was put on the NHS waiting list. It was then, in March 2025, she received a letter which said she had been referred to the pain management clinic. And last week, she finally had her appointment, nearly 3 years from her first one. But still, she had no injections. My back is now bent over so far, I am struggling with everything, walking especially, Miss Cook said. Even my volunteering job at Holt Cromer Community is now getting too much for me, and I may have to give it up, unless I get my back sorted. This job is my life, and I have nothing else. I get to meet and greet people, and I will be lost without the company of others. I cannot continue living like this. It's getting worse every day. It is debilitating. Chris Cobb, NNUH Chief Operating Officer, said, "We are very sorry for anyone waiting longer than expected for investigations and treatment, and know we have more to do. We continually review our waiting lists and we are prioritising cancer, the most urgent and longest waiting patients. Our trust has made a significant effort in reducing overall waiting times over the last year, with the waiting lists for planned care dropping from 82,000 to 65,000 patients in the last 4 months. We have also seen a reduction in long waits over this period. The pain management service is working hard to reduce the waiting times for first appointments and have created 2 advanced clinical practitioner roles to address this. This has also created flexibility with our pain management injection clinics. These posts have been filled and are operational, and as a result, there has been a 25% decrease in waiting times in this service.
They're calling it the Battle of the Barn. Locals in Blakeney are lining up to fight plans by an entrepreneur to convert a humble concrete structure into a hotel. The single-storey, 18-metre by 8-metre barn sits on the Morstan Road on the outskirts of the village and offers stunning views over the salt marshes towards the sea. Its owner, Daniel Broch, who founded the Everyman Cinema Group, wants to turn the property into a boutique hotel and farm shop after recently obtaining permission for a campsite on the field beside it. But villagers claim that development will blight views across the marshes, which sit in an area of outstanding national beauty, AONB, now known as a national landscape. The battle is the latest controversy to flare up over the barn, which is very close to a £6 million mansion which was given away in an amaze draw amid its own intense planning wrangle. A decade ago, Mr. Broch, who sold another mansion in the village for £6 million, which was also given away by amaze in a separate draw, withdrew similar plans for the barn in the face of a storm of objections. And in 2021, he was also refused permission to turn the structure into a house following another outcry. The latest skirmish started after Mr. Broch applied to North Norfolk District Council to change the use of the building under so-called permitted development rules. He wants to convert it into an office and farm shop, with three or four rooms behind it for guests. He described the plan as the latest chapter in the story of his love for Norfolk. But his vision for the land he owns is not shared by other villagers. Blakeney Parish Council said the hotel would harm the special qualities of the AONB. One villager posted it would have a devastating impact on the landscape, while others said they would be taking up the cudgels over the latest attempt to develop the site. One woman living nearby said, "We're not very keen on it at all. It's just all about developers versus the AONB. You can see it from here, you can see it from the coast path, you can see it from out on the water, you can see it from Clyde." But not everyone was convinced the hotel would ever materialise. One woman said, "He doesn't stand a hope in hell. Natural England won't want anything built on there." Mr. Broch was refused permission to convert the barn into a house in 2021 after a welter of objections. The council said the scheme would have an adverse impact on the AONB, and an appeal was dismissed the following year after a government planning inspector said it would cause substantial harm. Mr. Broch withdrew plans to turn the barn into a hotel in 2016 amid an earlier village uproar, with the parish council saying afterwards it was difficult to overstate the feeling in the community about the proposal. The block-built property forms part of Ager Farm, where a campsite with up to 50 pitches for tents and caravans has recently been agreed by the council.
A stark warning: water shortages could seriously threaten food production and rural businesses has been raised by the region's farmers. A House of Lords report has called for urgent action to improve the nation's drought resilience, including measures to help agriculture adapt to more frequent dry spells and tighter water restrictions. The Environment and Climate Change Committee's report, Surviving Drought, Reclaim the Rain, highlights particular risks facing East Anglia. Farmers in the region rely heavily on groundwater and are already experiencing the impact of longer, drier summers and unpredictable rainfall, made worse by climate change. The report was published in response to a formal inquiry launched in late 2025, following the driest spring for more than a century. The 2025 drought left rivers and reservoirs severely depleted and prompted warning of a possible water shortage for homes, businesses and food producers. James Beamish, director at the Hocum Farm Company in North Norfolk, gave evidence to the committee. He said rainfall events in East Anglia have become increasingly volatile and that this has been matched by a growing frequency of droughts during the growing season. Steve Moncaster, Managing Director of Norfolk Environment Food and Farming, NEFF, said one of the business gaps in current planning is an up-to-date economic assessment of drought's cost to the industry. He said the last serious attempt to quantify the cost of drought put the figure for the 2010-2012 event at £80 million for farms in England. The report warns that by 2055, public water demand in England could exceed supply by 5 billion litres a day, the equivalent to 20,000 Olympic swimming pools, if action is not taken. This comes against the backdrop of ageing infrastructure, rising demand from population growth and new water-intensive industries such as data centres and hydrogen production. The Environment Agency, EA, is already taking steps to reduce abstraction from the environment to protect vulnerable habitats, which may further limit water available to farmers. The committee calls for a whole-of-society approach to water management that goes beyond government action alone. The report outlines four key priorities for drought resilience. They include improved data on drought impacts, balancing supply and demand across the sectors, better support for users, reliance on direct abstraction, and streamlining existing drought planning systems. The committee held 11 evidence sessions and received 86 written submissions, including from farmers, academics, environmental groups, and water industry experts. Among the urgent recommendations are regulatory reforms to make it easier to build reservoirs, more flexible abstraction rights and incentives for new water storage on farms and in rural communities. Mark Beeston from the National Farmers Union told the committee that better access to capital funding, tax allowances for reservoirs on farms and improvements to the planning system are essential if the industry is to adapt. The report also highlights the need for clearer, more consistent early warning systems for drought, as well as improved regional coordination between government agencies, farmers, and other high-volume users. The committee recommends investment in real-time monitoring of soil moisture and better data integration to support early action and reduce the risk of last-minute water restrictions. Nature-based solutions are also highlighted, with the report supporting the use of wetland restoration, reforestation, and improved soil management as ways to increase water retention in the landscape. The Environment and Climate Change Committee is chaired by Baroness Sheehan and includes members with direct experience in farming, conservation, and water policy. The Earl of Leicester, a director of Holcombe Farming Company, also sits on the committee. The report concludes that drought remains a real and present threat to both rural economy and the wider environment. It warns that without urgent investment and action, the cost of inaction is likely to far exceed the investment required to build resilience. The committee has urged government to consider its recommendations and to prioritise the need of sectors most exposed to water scarcity. It warns future food security will depend on whether these actions are delivered in the critical years ahead.
More than 30 of Norfolk's fire stations are short of on-call crew, with nearly 70 vacancies hampering the ability of crews to get to emergencies. Of the county's 42 stations, 39 of them rely upon on-call firefighters, of which there are almost 470. But 32 of those stations have vacancies, and if stations cannot muster enough firefighters to send out a crew, it means appliances from further afield have to attend incidents. That can increase the time it takes to get to fires, crashes and other emergencies, with fire bosses keen to plug the gaps. Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service has struggled for years to recruit enough on-call personnel because retained firefighters must live or work within 5 minutes of an on-call station. Lifestyle changes and closures of businesses and companies in rural areas means it is increasingly difficult. Despite that, fire chiefs say their on-call appliance availability is more than 80%, which is one of the highest in the country. More than 60% of Norfolk's rural fire and rescue cover relies on on-call firefighters, while the county also has about 280 full-time firefighters. And fire chiefs are keen to fill the on-call gaps so the nearest possible fire stations are ready to respond when needed. Coinciding with a recruitment drive in what is thought to be a UK first, the Fire Service has developed a new charter for businesses which employ on-call firefighters. Companies which sign up to the NFRS On-Call Employers Charter agree to give on-call firefighter workers extra unpaid leave to develop and maintain life-saving skills on essential fire service training courses. King's Lynn-based pharmaceutical device manufacturers Bestpac, which has more than 800 staff, is the first employer to sign up to the charter. Kerry Sumner, Norfolk Chief Fire Officer, said, "We're extremely grateful to all the businesses in Norfolk who support their communities by allowing their employees to be on-call firefighters. The charter is a way for us to acknowledge the support they provide us and how much we value that relationship, and we'll be aiming to speak to as many of them as we can over the coming months." Employing an on-call firefighter has numerous benefits, such as developing links with your local fire station and the wider community, and adding practical, life-saving skills to your workforce. Organisations which sign up will also receive discounted fire and rescue training packages for their organisation. Kevin Reed, King's Lynn site manager for Bestpac, said, "Pledging our commitment to this initiative sets a great precedent for our on-call firefighters, both the ones who work for Bestpac now, but also for aiding our recruitment in the future." Bestpac currently employs two NFRS on-call firefighters, Phil Berry and Adam Wolfe, as manufacturing engineers, reserving them two parking spaces to allow them to exit quickly if they get called to an incident while on shift. Mr. Berry said, "I'm proud to be part of the first organisation to sign up. We're really grateful for what Bestpac allow us to do for our on-call role. And the addition of the car parking spaces has been fantastic for us to allow us to respond as quickly as possible." There are on-call firefighting vacancies for stations in Acle, Attleborough, Aylsham, Cromer, Dereham, Diss, Downham Market, Earlham, East Harling, Galston, Great Yarmouth, Harleston, Heacham, Heatherset, Hingham, Hunstanton, King's Lynn, Loddon, Martham, Massingham, Methwold, Munsley, Outwell, Reefham, Sandringham, Stalham, Terrington, Thetford, Wotton, Wells, West Walton and Wyndham.
Attempted break-ins at two Norfolk fire stations may be part of a troubling trend of burglars trying to steal life-saving equipment so they can use them in other crimes. Two fire stations in Reefham and Great Massingham were targeted last week, with the suspects thwarted when the alarms went off. The break-in bids are similar to recent incidents at fire stations in Cambridgeshire, Lincolnshire and Bedfordshire, where thousands of pounds worth of cutting equipment and hydraulic tools have been stolen. 3 years ago, more than £23,000 of tools from a fire appliance, including bolt cutters, side cutters and a power saw, were stolen in a burglary at Martham Fire Station near Great Yarmouth. Such equipment is used by firefighters to free victims from the wreckage of vehicles which have been in crashes. But it is believed criminals target such kit to use in other crimes, including ATM thefts, or to sell the tools on. Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service bosses urged the public to help track down the criminals, and they had increased security at fire stations. Scott Norman, Deputy Chief Fire Officer, said, "Any crime against emergency services is disappointing. Had the thieves stolen life-saving equipment, this that would then not have been available for fire crews attending emergencies. Our fire stations sit at the heart of rural communities across Norfolk, and any support from those local communities to identify the criminals or report suspicious activity is appreciated. Norfolk Constabulary is appealing for witnesses to the two Norfolk attempted burglaries. The first, at Reefham Fire Station on School Road, happened at 11:40pm on Tuesday, May the 19th. A window pane on the fire station was removed, but the burglar or burglars fled when the alarm sounded. The second burglary, where a suspect did manage to get into Great Massingham Fire Station, happened at 1am on Wednesday, May the 20th. They got into the fire station in Station Road through a window before fleeing empty-handed after being disturbed by the alarm. Any witnesses or anyone with further information should contact Norfolk Police.
A schoolboy became the hero after helping to rescue a snake that had been missing for a year. The reptile rescue took place in Reefham on Friday when a bull snake was found in the pipework of Diane's Pantry in Market Place. Kevin Murphy of Norfolk Wildlife Rescue promptly arrived to try and retrieve the animal. The snake got lost a year ago and its owner moved to Essex, Mr. Murphy said. It had gone along a gutter, down a pipe and into the ground. I was trying everything. I was poking tools down the pipes to try and push it out. I also tried flushing water down the pipe to see if that would bring the snake out. By this time, Mr. Murphy had been up at the top of his ladder for hours and was covered in muck. School children started to gather, so a sign was put in front of the pipe to deter them from getting too close. A young lad walked up and pointed at the sign and said, "Snake," Mr. Murphy explained. I said, "No, that's just the sign." But he said, "No, look, a snake." Sure enough, the snake was sitting on the ground, poking its head around the sign. He swiftly netted the snake, which was taken away by the mother of its original owner. "It was a real team effort," Mr. Murphy added. "I'm up a ladder all hot and sweaty and covered in muck, and this kid manages to find it straight away. I dread to think how long I'd have been up there if he hadn't seen it." Bull snakes are a venomous, constricting species, typically reaching lengths of 4 to 8 feet. They are native to the USA and Mexico and feast on rats, squirrels and rabbits.
A bus driver has lost his job following a crash in which a cyclist was seriously injured. Justin Chatfield had been driving the number 21 first bus on the B1108 when it was involved in the crash at the junction near the Spire Hospital on the outskirts of Norwich. The bus had been travelling towards the city, but was turning left onto Old Wotton Road towards the hospital for a stop. The cyclist was heading away from the city and turning right onto the Old Wotton Road. Norwich Crown Court heard that as he made his turn, the bus driver was required to give way to traffic from the right, but pulled out in front of the cyclist, causing him to take evading action and hitting an oncoming Mini. Charles Myatt, prosecuting, said the cyclist suffered serious injuries. Chatfield, 51, of the street Ridlington, North Walsham, was subsequently charged with causing serious injury by careless or inconsiderate driving following the crash on July 28 last year. He appeared at court this month when he denied the charge but admitted a lesser offence of careless driving. Andrew Thompson, mitigating, said the defendant had accepted he misjudged the speed of the cyclist. He said the brief misjudgment was hugely out of character for Chatfield, who has a clean driving licence and who had been driving a bus for 3.5 years at the time without any similar incidents. Following the incident, Mr. Thompson said Chatfield lost his job at First Bus but has since got new employment as a professional driver. Recorder Nicola Fitches fined him £200 and ordered he pay £80 costs. Chatfield's licence will also be endorsed with 3 penalty points. A spokesman for First said, "Our thoughts remain with the cyclist who was injured. Safety is our priority and we expect our drivers to maintain the highest driving standards." Sergeant Callum Walchester from Norfolk Constabulary said, "Whilst professional drivers undertake extensive training and carry significant responsibility, this case highlights that even experienced drivers can make errors."
A Credit Union is being recognised for its work in protecting communities from illegal lending. Norfolk First Credit Union has received official accreditation from the England Illegal Money Lending Team's Stop Loan Shark scheme, in recognition of its efforts to combat illegal money lending and raise awareness among its members. The credit union, which serves people living and working in Norfolk, has worked with Stop Loan Sharks for the past 10 years. Dave Benbow, head of Stop Loan Sharks, said, "We're delighted to welcome Norfolk First Credit Union as an official partner. Their support plays a vital role in helping us disrupt illegal lending, which causes immense harm to individuals and communities." Scott Porter, director of Norfolk First Credit Union, said, "Achieving partner status from Stop Loan Sharks is a great achievement for Norfolk First Credit Union. We have been working with Stop Loan Sharks for over 10 years, giving our members advice, information, resources, and credible alternatives to being drawn into using loan sharks. Among the services offered by Norfolk First Credit Union is a coastal loan, which helps those who live by the coast and who can be affected by seasonal work, self-employment and variable incomes to access fair and manageable borrowing. The coastal loan is for those living or working within 10 miles of the coast in Norfolk and who are not already a member of Norfolk First Credit Union. Eligible people can borrow between £200 and £500 with flexible terms and the option to choose a repayment period of between 6 and 12 months. The loan comes with a fixed interest rate of 3% per month, 42.5% APR, with no hidden fees. A small portion of each repayment goes into savings, so savings grow while the loan is repaid. To find out more about Norfolk First Credit Union, visit norfolkfirstcu.com.
A walking route which runs beside a vintage steam railway line has been named among the UK's best. The Bure Valley Path, which stretches between Aylsham and Hofton, earned its place on the list in a recent feature published by The Guardian. The list was compiled by explorer, author and television presenter Nicholas Crane, who wanted to encourage people to explore some of the country's oldest pathways. One of my favourite walks traces the banks of the River Bure between the market town of Aylsham and the railway village of Hofton, he wrote. He called the Bure Valley a typical gentle Norfolk Valley of slow meanders, cascading willows, kingfishers and herons. It was like this 100 years ago, when huge timber sailing barges, wherries, used to glide silently upriver to Aylsham's mills, he said. He explained that the 9-mile Bure Valley Path follows the route of the narrow gauge steam line, the Bure Valley Railway. Mr. Crane recommends taking the steam train from Hofton to Aylsham and walking back part of the route. The Bure Valley Path also offers connections to riverside footpaths, historic water mills and old navigation locks. Walkers can finish the route at Coltishall, where the author suggests a stop at the Rising Sun pub before returning to Hofton.
A man accused of stabbing another man in Norfolk refused to leave his cell to attend a court hearing. Ryan Palmer, 32, had been charged with wounding with intent and having an article with a blade or point. It follows an incident on Rowton Road, Cromer, when another man was found with a stab wound to his abdomen. Palmer, of Brownshill, in the town, was arrested following the incident, which happened at about 9:15 p.m. on April the 11th and subsequently charged. He was due to appear at Norwich Crown Court on Thursday for a plea and trial preparation hearing, but Palmer did not leave his cell and the case was relisted for June the 8th. The man hurt in the incident was taken to the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital for treatment.
Trading standards officers in Norfolk are being abused by shop owners whilst on the job, say council bosses. The admission comes in the weeks after the BBC showcased the violent threat being levelled at officers across the country. A survey of enforcement officers found that more than 70% of officers who work for local authorities in England, Wales and Scotland, and more centrally in Northern Ireland, have been faced with threats of intimidation or violence. Norfolk officers are no different, a spokesman for the County Council said. Sadly, our trading standard officers would recognise the environment described in the recent BBC report from their own experience working in Norfolk, he said. Officers have encountered non-cooperation and, on occasion, resistance and intimidatory behaviour during inspections, particularly where illicit goods such as illegal tobacco and vapes are involved. While this isn't the full picture, and many business owners and employees work with our staff with professionalism and courtesy, our officers always deserve to be safe from abuse while at work, and we work closely with Norfolk Constabulary to ensure our officers are properly supported and protected in carrying out their duties.
A missing man has been found dead on a North Norfolk beach after falling off a cliff. Emergency services were called to the scene of a serious incident on Tuesday on the beach below the cliffs near Sheringham Golf Club, where an air ambulance has landed. It comes after a man in his 70s was reported missing from his home in the town at 11 a.m. While police were searching, they found a man with serious injuries on the beach, which they said were consistent with a fall from height. An eyewitness said they saw somebody fall from the cliffs above the beach. The man was pronounced dead at the scene. The death is not being treated as suspicious, and the family of the missing man has been informed. A 13-year-old from Sheringham was on the beach with his friends as emergency services attended to the man. He said, "There was one police officer here and another police officer sat in the car. There were four or five coast guards. We were a bit confused about it at first. We didn't know whether he was dead or unconscious."
The Norfolk Broads have been named among the UK's best national parks for spending time outdoors alone, though the area is not technically a national park. The waterways have been ranked third out of 15 national parks in a new solo-friendly travel index created by outdoor clothing brand TOG24. Despite having a more limited network of routes compared to other parks, the brand cited the Broads' flat terrain and lack of strenuous routes, making it one of the most accessible national parks. The top spot was given to the New Forest, which was given a score of 8.5, while the Broads achieved a 7.95 out of 10. The solo season campaign was developed with input from clinical psychologist Dr. Charlotte Russell, who emphasised the value of solitude. "Intentional solitude is extremely beneficial for us and an important way of looking after our mental health in a world where many of us are busy and stressed," she said. Although the Broads have the same status as a national park, they are actually established under separate legislation because of the need to take into account the navigational role of the waterways.
A £500,000 church transformation project has reached a major milestone with the completion of a renewed community space. Haveringland Parish Church, part of the Aylsham and District Team Ministry and in the Diocese of Norwich, has been refurbished into a modern community hub. The project concluded with a day-long conference focused on the future of rural churches held at the church on May the 15th. The day, attended by around 100 people, included keynote speeches from Bishop Jane Steen and Cambridge architect Nigel Walter. Reverend Andrew Whitehead, Vicar of Causton, said, "It was amazing to see people streaming into this isolated rural church for the conference on Friday. So much wisdom was shared in the addresses and in the panel discussions. Everybody came away having learnt something new, and we hope we've inspired delegates to return to their own churches with a refreshed sense of enthusiasm." Funding for the project and conference were provided by the National Lottery Heritage Fund. The event closed with a contemporary rogation service, blessing the land, farmers and communities.
A school has received a generous donation to support pupil wellbeing and enrichment activities. Sheringham Woodfield School, which provides education for children with complex learning and health needs, was presented with a cheque for £3,459 from the Sheringham branch of Tesco. The funds were raised through the sale of second-hand books at the store. Annette McConachie, head teacher at Sheringham Woodfield School, said, "This incredibly generous gift equates to a lot of book sales, so thank you to Tesco's and its customers." It comes on the back of a donation of over £6,000 from larger Tesco stores within East Anglia, raised through in-store fundraising during 2025. "I think we can count Tesco's as a very staunch supporter, so a big thank you from pupils and staff," Miss McConachie explained. "That part of the donation will fund a healthy breakfast for every pupil to start the day. The remaining funds will support enrichment week, trips and outings, as well as a new playground equipment. The school employs more than 160 staff and supports 160 pupils."
A major overnight fire tore through a well-known Norfolk Broads boatyard. Emergency crews were called to Marsh Road in Houghton shortly after midnight on Saturday, where a large blaze broke out at the site of Landemall's Yacht Builders. Firefighters from Wroxham, Sproston, Earlham, Carrow, Stalham and King's Lynn battled the flames for several hours. Crews remained at the scene until around 7 a.m. to ensure the area was safe. Photographs taken afterwards show significant damage seen to a building at the long-established boatyard. People arriving in the area later in the morning said they were shocked by what they saw. One couple, who were packing up their car nearby, said, "I don't know what happened, but it looks quite bad from what I can see." Another passerby, walking her dog close to the site, added, "I just hope everyone is okay, really." The cause of the fire is not yet known.
You might not realise it when they're screaming overhead or trying to pinch your chips, but new research suggests gulls are in sharp decline because they're struggling to cope with modern life. The Thetford-based British Trust for Ornithology, BTO, which carried out a nationwide survey of 6 species of gull over 2 successive winters, says it revealed a bleak picture of falling numbers. Volunteers counted numbers of roosting black-headed gulls, common gulls, lesser black-backed gulls, herring gulls, great black-backed gulls and Mediterranean gulls over 2023-24 and 2024-25. Numbers of black-headed gulls in the Wash fell from 17,890 to 2,050 over the 2 winters, while numbers on the Nene Washes in Cambridgeshire fell from 11,000 to 6,400. The BTO, which has been carrying out gull counts since the 1950s, said the latest figures revealed substantial population decline by 4 of the 5 main wintering species, while the total number of gulls wintering in the UK has decreased from 3.9 million to just under 2.5 million over the last 20 years. It blames bird flu, changing farming practices, climate change, changes in waste management with less rubbish going to landfill and fisheries discards. Emma Caulfield, BTO research ecologist who coordinated the survey, said, "These figures are pretty alarming and suggest that these enigmatic gulls are having a tough time across the UK. Despite these smart and adaptable birds figuring out how to live alongside us, the ever-changing world appears to be moving too fast for them to keep up. By understanding the problems these familiar and widespread birds are facing, we can hope to reverse some of the negative trends and work to ensure that they remain a part of our cherished seaside environment." Black-headed gulls have declined by almost a half in the last 20 years. The BTO blames the drop on the impact of bird flu on its breeding colonies in the summer of 2023. The UK's largest, the great black-backed gull, saw a drop of up to 66% wintering in the UK. Lesser black-backed gulls suffered a 47% decline during the same period, while common gull numbers fell by 26%. Common gulls have decreased in England but remain stable in Scotland and Wales, while great black-backed gulls showed significant declines in England and Scotland and significant increases in Northern Ireland.
The owner of a Norfolk holiday fern has shared the inspiration behind her impressive dog-friendly journey across the county. Sue Allen, founder of East Ruston Cottages, completed an 80-mile walk visiting every one of her company's dog-friendly holiday cottages over the course of 4 days. The walk raised more than £6,000 in support of medical detection dogs and Little Lifts, a Norfolk-based charity that provides care boxes to people undergoing breast cancer treatment. Miss Allen said she was inspired to do this after one of her business's cottage owners recently went through breast cancer treatment and was supported by Little Lifts during that time. She said Little Lifts made such a difference to her, and it really was what planted the seed of this whole fundraising idea. Medical Detection Dogs is a charity which trains dogs to assist people with complex health conditions. The walk, which took place over 4 days, starting on May the 14th, saw Miss Allen travel through coastal villages, countryside footpaths and communities, stopping at cafes, pubs and businesses. She was joined along the way by her dogs, as well as guests, cottage owners and supporters, and it was dubbed the Big Boob and Bark Walk. Miss Allen said it was quite hard, but most of it was absolutely joyous. She described crossing the finish line as beautiful and uplifting, and said it was much more than I expected. Miss Allen founded East Ruston Cottages in 2008 after struggling to find holiday accommodation that welcomed dogs. Today, the business offers 40 dog-friendly cottages across Stalham and the Haysborough area, from cosy lodges to family homes. The firm is now recognised as one of the UK's most dog-friendly holiday providers.
Chemicals in pet flea treatments are causing severe and potentially irreversible harm to rivers and wildlife across Norfolk. An assessment made by ecologist Matt Shardlow warns the toxic chemicals are widespread in rivers, estuaries and lakes. His review said chemicals banned from use as commercial pesticides are highly toxic to aquatic life and are likely to be hitting bird populations that rely on insects for food, as well as reducing pollinators such as bees in public parks. He pointed to the Norfolk Broads, where all the main rivers entering the park are heavily contaminated with flea treatment toxins and are concerns about 90% decline in dragonfly numbers on the Bewer site of special scientific interest. Mr. Shardlow, founding chief executive of wildlife charity Bug Life, said across Britain, our rivers, public parks, national parks, and most special wildlife sites are being damaged potentially irreparably by exceedingly high levels of toxic intact nerve agents. Flea and tick treatments are commonly used on nation's millions of dogs and cats and are said to be the main route that chemicals such as fipronil and imidacloprid follow to pollute the environment. The treatment enters the environment through the sewage system from washing treated animals or washing of owners' clothing and bedding that the chemicals have rubbed off on. They can also get into the environment when dogs go swimming in water or when pets rub against vegetation or are rained on. It comes after Dereham Town Council urged dog owners to avoid letting their pets swim in local ponds or rivers due to the contamination. Efforts to stop the chemicals getting into the environment by improving sewage plants would be slow and expensive, while measures to prevent pets swimming or being petted for months after an application would be highly unpopular or ignored, Mr. Shardlow said. He said the only sensible option would be for the government's Veterinary Medicines Directorate to review and suspend and ban the flea treatments containing fipronil and imidacloprid.
Almost 450 Norfolk households have been awarded grants to help them cope with the rising cost of heating oil, while 200 more have been turned down. Norfolk County Council launched the £3 million heating oil crisis fund to help low-income families struggling to cope with costs as the war in the Middle East sent costs soaring. About 70,000 households in the county, 17% of homes, rely on the fuel for heating and hot water. But the US-Israeli conflict with Iran meant heating oil prices doubled, leaving some in Norfolk struggling to pay for their supplies. The Labour government provided local authorities with more than £50 million to help, which prompted the creation of the Norfolk Heating Oil Crisis Fund in March. Aimed at low-income families, typically households with a combined income of under £35,000 a year, the County Council confirmed that it has awarded grants to 443 households, declined 202, while there are 71 still in progress. People who apply are asked to provide information about themselves and anyone else who lives with them. That includes 2 months of bank statements, details of outstanding debts, and whether they have an oil payment plan in place before eligibility can be confirmed. Priority is given to those who are due to run out of oil and are at imminent risk of losing access to heating and their hot water. The council also takes savings and any outstanding debts into account to ensure the support reaches those who need it most, with grants of around £350 offered per household. A county hall spokesman said that, based on current demand, the authority is letting people know whether they have been successful within 3 days of applications being received. Visit www.norfolk.gov.uk/heatingoil to apply for the council's crisis funding. Or for those who cannot access support online, call 0344 800 8020.
You are listening to edition number 2019 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 29th of May 2026. We have articles about a newly extended soft play zone, an artist's challenge, a David Attenborough scarecrow, and Slimmer's helping cancer research, plus the Mardler magazine supplement. But first, one obituary this week and news on one upcoming event.
Edith Mary Allen passed away peacefully on May the 20th, aged 101. Edith was wife of the late Fred Allen and mother of Ruth. The funeral service will be held in All Saints Church, Weybourne, on Thursday, June the 4th at 11:30 a.m. All inquiries should be directed to Lloyd Durham Funeral Services on 01263 713
Forthcoming events include on Friday, the 5th of June, 10 a.m. to noon, a charity coffee morning at Honing Village Hall, the street Honing, tea, coffee, bacon rolls and homemade cakes on sale to raise funds for Colney Centre at the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement. Include building a Neolithic hall, Clyde Marsh's past and present and future, and to cheer up, avoid the news. But first, a life-changing experience on the waters of Norfolk. Sailing Seas, Shaping Lives, For more than 40 years, the Norfolk Boat has been giving young people and those with disabilities the opportunity to sail offshore. And as we discover, for many it has been a life-changing experience. We have a tagline, Sailing Seas, Shaping Lives. We all feel that it is the essence of the Norfolk Boat, says Anthony Hunt. For more than 40 years, the charity has been giving young people aged 12 to 24 and those with disabilities of any age the opportunity to experience sailing out at sea. And Anthony, chair of the organisation, and the rest of the team have seen time and time again the many ways in which it has enriched the lives of participants. It's a fact that quite often they perhaps struggle at school or at college. Perhaps it's academically or socially, and they can't quite find their place, and as a consequence, they never get asked to be involved in anything, says Anthony. We get reports back from young people who have been on our sailing trips, and they have been given a responsibility. They did the night watch, or they made breakfast for everybody, or they had a cleaning task to do. Those that got the most out of it are the ones who embrace it. They show a resilience that they never knew they had and experience working as part of a team. They might get seasick, but they still love it. The Norfolk Boat was founded by Andrew Cuthbert in the early 1980s, and he is still a director and life president. He was a naval man and understood the benefits of sail training for young people, how it gave them a sense of camaraderie, a sense of worth, and really helped them, says Anthony. In 1980, Andrew organised the Holcombe Country Fair, and the profits, together with donations from generous Norfolk individuals, trusts and the Marine Society, raised enough to buy a 50% share in a custom-built 79-foot Robert Clark ketch named Spirit of Boadicea. Her co-owners were the Ocean Youth Club. The rest of the money was invested, with the dividend paying for bursaries for young people who could not afford the full voyage fees to receive sail training. From 1982, the Spirit of Boadicea spent many happy seasons sailing out of East Coast harbours. She entered the tall ships race on numerous occasions and became a regular sight in many Dutch ports. At the turn of the millennium, the decision was taken that the Spirit of Boadicea should be sold and for the charity to enter into a new phase of assisting young people of Norfolk into going to sea. Today, the Norfolk Boat offers funds to young people from all walks of life to help them afford to sail on sea-going boats run by approved sail training organisations. Anthony has been involved with the Norfolk Boat for more than 20 years. He joined the charity when he moved back to his home county from London in 2005. He knew Andrew Cuthbert as he was a friend of his father and became chair in 2023. Andrew approached me to see if I would become one of the directors of the Norfolk Boat, which I gladly accepted because I liked what the charity was doing for Norfolk's young people, he says. He works alongside a team, including administrator Nikki Phillips, who assesses all the funding applications from organisations and individuals. Those that are successful are then linked up with the trip providers, who are all registered with the Association of Sail Training Organisations. The Norfolk Boat mostly works with Ocean Youth Trust, the Cerdon Sailing Trust, the Excelsior Trust, and the Sea Change Sailing Trust. The charity covers 50% of the cost of the trip, sometimes more depending on circumstances. Like so many charities, costs are rising, so raising awareness of their work and fundraising is more important than ever, and they are hugely grateful to the local donors who give so generously. Last year they spent £55,000 and sent about 133 people to sea. And this year, they've already pledged to help 119 young people at a cost of just under £50,000. Despite Norfolk being a coastal county, for the majority of the young people who go on the trips, it's the first time they've been out on the water. And for some, it's even the first time they've been to the beach. Says Nikki, a lot of our young sailors are local school children from along the North Norfolk coast, and some of them haven't even been to their own coast or had a passport. And from that position, some of them have been sailing in the tall ships' races in the Baltic. Some are booked to go again this summer, which takes them across to Sweden. Some do trips across to Holland. So, from a personal development trajectory, what we're talking about is widening their horizons. This year, students from local schools and sixth forms will be going on trips along with groups from YMCA, Norfolk Youth Advisory Service and Holt Youth Project. The young people who sail this summer will include asylum seekers, some who are homeless, young carers, bereaved children and youngsters who are living below the poverty line. For some of these children, sailing hasn't come across their radar because historically it has been seen as a pursuit of the wealthy. But actually it's open for everyone, and it's a game changer once they get out there, says Nikki. Some of them are very reluctant and quite scared, but if they can do that for a week out in the North Sea, they can pretty much do anything really. One of the conditions of being granted a bursary is that a participant will keep a diary about their trip, which may be another new skill for them. And there are some very inspiring stories about the incredible impact that the trips have had. For some, it sparks a lifelong love of sailing. A lot of the young people who go on these voyages and sail for a week with the Serdan Sailing Trust or Excelsior Trust quite often end up volunteering with those trusts on a regular basis. And some of them actually end up working with them, says Nikki. I know of someone who works with the Excelsior Trust who was one of our original sailors, so it sends them off on a journey career-wise as well. We had a local lad from Reefham High School who was from a single-parent family and had never been sailing before. It made him realise that he could achieve a lot more than he thought. He went on to study medicine at Bristol and he is now a doctor. He still volunteers with another sailing organisation and he made a big donation to us last year because he said for him it really changed his life. And each year one of our promising young sailors is the recipient of the Cuthbert Award. Nominations are put forward by either the leader of the group or the skipper, or both. And they put forward a young person who shows they've really gone above and beyond, says Nikki. Last year's winner was a 12-year-old from Norwich who had been struggling at school. He hadn't been in a classroom within mainstream schooling for the previous 2 years. He'd never been offshore, he'd never been on a boat before, and he absolutely flourished. And as a result of that, he was awarded the prize, which gave him £1,000 worth of sailing vouchers to use when he wants. So we hope that's the start of a whole new journey for him. That article was from the North Norfolk News of the 8th of May, 2026.
Next, let's build a Neolithic hall. It's a sound that someone who lived in the Stone Age would instantly recognise, the gentle percussion of flint on wood. And if they were alive today, they might also understand why they were hearing it. The construction of an authentic Neolithic hall in the shadow of Stonehenge. When the new structure opens this summer, it will act as an immersive, living classroom where children can experience firsthand what life was like in the Neolithic period. In the autumn, a new world-class learning centre will open at Stonehenge with a STEM, Science, Technology, Engineering and Mathematics, Discovery Lab, and opportunities for digital learning. This transformative project is truly inspiring, says Matt Thompson, Conservation, Curatorial and Learning Director. We'll be offering youngsters the perfect mix of heritage, magic and modern-day science and technology. We'll bring the spirit and stories of Stonehenge to life and give children the chance to walk in the shoes of our Neolithic ancestors. They'll see the stones and stand in that magical landscape surrounded by archaeology. You just can't get that in a classroom. That's how you set their imaginations racing and light the spark for future generations. This full immersion ethos applies to the build of the Kusama Neolithic Hall. It's constructed using the same materials, techniques and tools that our distant ancestors would have used. The approach has sparked adult imaginations too. Unusually for such a large project, the hall is being built almost entirely by a team of about 80 volunteers, many of whom have no or limited experience in construction. "I had some woodworking skills," says Ian McQueen, a retired vet who's chipping away to fashion a huge tenon joint. "I wanted to be part of the heritage of my local area. I wanted to feel what it was like for people back then and to put myself in their shoes." He's surrounded by the trunks of dozens of fallen trees, ash, oak and Scots pine, that were all used here in prehistoric times and that have had their bark scraped away and are being shaped. Their size gives a hint of the scale of the hall. It will eventually measure 15 metres long, 8 metres wide and 7 metres high, nearly as tall as the nearby Stonehenge stones. It's been tough work. The build has been taking place during winter as the hazel branches needed for the hurdles, woven wooden panels placed around the frame of the building and covered in clay or earth to make a wall or left bare as fencing, can only be cut then. But despite the physical graft and cold, wet conditions, the volunteers are full of enthusiasm. And although modern tools are available, one of the biggest attractions of the project is the chance to work with flint. It's a chance that accountant Rachel Dawes, who comes from Surrey to work on the site, has longed for. Brought up near the Iron Age forts and barrows of Dorset, she has always been fascinated by prehistoric cultures and remembers the thrill of being able to touch the stones at Stonehenge and Avebury as a child. For someone who's interested in this period of history, it's a huge opportunity to work out what it's like to hold those stones and tools and use them, she says. "Doing this project makes me feel connected to the people who built the monuments here. I've even found a method to recreate the same beautiful finish that people were making 5,000 years ago." Over at one end of the site, Edris Luprian, a PhD student and retired teacher, records the number of blows it takes another volunteer to create a channel in the timber using a flint axe. The data she collects will help Luke Winter, an experimental archaeologist and the driving force behind the build, calculate the number of hours it would have taken a Neolithic community to build a similar structure. "It's a fantastic work with these tools," Edris says. "You realise how effective they were. I'm doing the tasks and meeting great new people. It's been amazing to have these opportunities." "The Kusama Neolithic Hall is remarkable," says Matt, taking stock of progress so far. "The volunteers building it are integral to what we're doing here. The dedication and enthusiasm of this fantastic community, who give up their time for free, is bringing our Stonehenge version to life. Together we're creating something that will inspire the next generation of people who will in turn care for these places and share their passion with others. It's about now, the future and those who will follow us. And that's what's exciting." That article by Gila Petrosini appeared in the spring issue of the English Heritage Members magazine.
And now Norfolk Wildlife Trust's Cly and Salthouse Marshes is history in the making. Purchased in 1926 by Norfolk Naturalists Trust, NWT's forerunner, Cly Marshes became the National County Wildlife Trust movement's first nature reserve 100 years ago. To this day, it still holds a special place in the hearts of naturalists from all over the UK. There are certainly few birdwatchers that haven't heard of Cly Marshes, and it's a place of pilgrimage and a rite of passage for so many. It was no coincidence that my first trip to Cly in 1981 came shortly after buying my first car. An expedition to North Norfolk from East London, newly qualified and in a Ford Corsair that was nearly as old as me, was quite an experience. It was long before SatNav, so required the careful study of a roadmap the night before. Departing at dawn the following day, I travelled on a wing and a prayer and a flask of coffee. But such was the draw of Clyde for young birdwatcher, and with the new freedom of a car, I couldn't be kept away. It was autumn, and my recollection is marvelling at the sheer quantity and variety of birds. It was that time of year, the sweet spot for birders, when you can see swallows and Brent geese on the same day. And of course, there is the chance of a wayward rarity, something Clyde was especially known for. But information about the latest rarities and migrants was hard to come by. No messaging service, WhatsApp groups or online up-to-date info, not even Birdline. It was Nancy's Caff that was the information exchange hub for birders. At one time you got a free breakfast if you manned the telephone for an hour, repeating the same bird report over and over. A look in the birding logbook to see if there is anything about always came before ordering food. Of course, Clyde Marshes now is both different and the same. There is now NWT's award-winning visitor centre along the coast road that is modern and spacious. It holds events and exhibitions and has a well-stocked gift and bookshop and a caff with spectacular view. It also has volunteers and staff dispensing information. With successive purchases of land, the reserve is much larger now, running along the coast beyond Salthouse to the Quag. There are paths running back and forth to various hides overlooking salt and freshwater marshes, reed beds and saline lagoons, and the variety and quantity of birds is still impressive. Although since my first visit we can add spoonbill, little egret, great white egret, glossy ibis, and common crane to the list of avian regulars. The reserve information leaflet states that as well as paths and boardwalks to six different hides, there is a raised hardened bank. Calling the famous East Bank a raised hardened bank is like calling Jerusalem a religious town. No pathway in the country has had more birdwatchers walk upon it. The reed bed that runs up the western side of the bank has provided so many people with their first glimpse of marsh harrier, bearded tit or bittern. These are birds that are almost taken for granted on a trip out in Norfolk now, but were exceptionally rare. Arnold Marsh is at the north end of East Bank, I'm willing to wager, has had more recorded rarities than any other plot of soggy marshland in the UK. New pathways such as Attenborough's Walk to the Babcock Hide or the portable Gilmore Discovery Hide are great new additions. Like us all, Clyde Marshes has had some sadness and setbacks. The Great Flood of January 1953, like all low-lying areas in East Anglia, hit Clyde hard. A similar storm surge over the 5th and 6th of December in 2013 was the worst in living memory. The shingle ridge was torn apart and over 2 metres of water sat on the coast road. The warden, Bernard Bishop, had the North Sea lapping at his front door. I was involved with the clear-up and it was some job, with garden furniture from the village wedged into hides, boardwalks lifted and tossed away, and the thick dark silt everywhere. For me, it was the sheer quantity of dead wildlife that had stuck with me. Dead frogs and mice were scattered all around, and drowned hares lay next to drowned stoats. Sadly, in the following month, disaster struck again. A US military helicopter crashed on the shingle bank, killing all four of the crew. Another flooding event in 2017 again required all hands on deck to clean up. Anyone living to 100 years old must experience their fair share of joy and sadness, celebration and commiseration, and as it is with Clyde Marshes. With climate change, more frequent storms and rising sea levels, it is generally accepted that Clyde Marshes will eventually revert to salt marsh. However, to stave off the inevitable and to allow a managed retreat of the freshwater marsh and pools, a deep drainage channel referred to as the New Cut has been excavated, and this will allow quicker drainage of the saltwater after flooding. Despite Clyde having to endure the caprice of time and tide, the last 100 years has shown us its resilience. Clyde Marshes is an example that a loved and valued natural world can recover, thrive, teem with wildlife once again. From its purchase to present day and into the future, Norfolk Wildlife Trust will ensure that Clyde and Salthouse Marshes Nature Reserve will remain, in the words of its founders, held in perpetuity as a breeding bird sanctuary. That article by Robert Morgan appeared in the North Norfolk News on the 9th of May 2026.
And to finish this week's supplement, therapist told me avoiding the news would clear my depression. It's been a few years since I was in hospital being treated for severe depression, but it was an experience that I can never forget. We had therapy sessions where we were advised to try certain techniques to help improve our mental state. One of them was to get plenty of sleep and plenty of exercise. Another was to try meditation, something I struggled with on account of being irritated by the sound of a wretched leaf blower right outside the windows on most days. And the third bit of advice was to stop looking at and reading about the news. This last was a bit tricky for me, as my job at that time was as a newsreader on Anglia TV. So, unless I quit my telly role, I had no choice but to follow the news almost every day. There was a certain irony in this, but I understood what the psychiatrists meant. It is hard not to be depressed and concerned by the constant bombardment of awful stories. I don't read the news for a living anymore, but it's still virtually impossible to avoid it. There's so much cruelty, particularly to children and to animals, both of which have me reaching for the remote switch. I know this is a cop-out, and I know that I should be made aware of what goes on in the world, but I just can't bring myself to look. And yet it's not always possible to avoid grim content. For instance, in between innocuous repeats, the RSPCA brings us pictures of sick and injured animals, while various charities show children in distress who need money and medical help. When these appeals come on the screen, I often have to turn the other way or leave the room altogether. And I am ashamed of this. I wish I could face it, but I can't. The recent mention of the escaped calf being rammed by a police driver was truly upsetting. I didn't see the collision, but the pictures of the forlorn creature afterwards were a sorry sight. Luckily, the animal did recover fully. A former police officer said that from his training it seemed the right thing to do for the safety of the public, and a farmer agreed. By the way, the former policeman was a Mr. Ram, and I'm not making this up. In the past, we had details of stories on the news that would be edited to spare the viewers, acknowledging their sensibilities. Nowadays, it seems nothing is spared, though there's often that warning that some viewers may find these scenes distressing. How journalists covering wars cope with what they witness is incredible. Safe in the studio, I used to deal with it by becoming detached from the story. As I turned the page, or as it later became the auto cue, and moved to the next story, I'd forgotten what I'd just read. Being on the box gave me great opportunities, but it wasn't all wine and roses. It did have a downside. When I was on telly in the West Country, I worked for a while alongside Fern Britton. Eventually, she went on to greater things, and I was so sorry to learn that she had become the victim of a stalker. Thankfully, he's now been prosecuted. This never happened to me, I'm happy to say, but some years ago, one of my Anglia pals was threatened over quite a long period of time. What made it more distressing was the fact that she was pregnant. Eventually, the police became involved and the stalking stopped. The stalkers? It turned out that the guilty parties were a couple of women. The worst I ever got was a sheaf of very rude photos of what I thought was me talking into a microphone, accompanied by suggestive words. Of course, the microphone wasn't a microphone. I got a letter from the sender asking me to marry him, if not, sent him a photo. What, another one? Anyway, to keep him quiet, I sent him an elegant study. Years later, I heard that the photo was for sale on eBay, with a price tag of 50 pence. Bidders so far?
None.
Ah, well, that's showbiz. And that item by Helen McDermott appeared in the EDP on the 25th of June, 2024. Our thanks go to the editors and contributors of the English Heritage magazine, the EDP, and the North Norfolk News for permission to use their material.
We now finish with our final selection of news and views, starting with newly extended soft play zone to open in church. A newly extended soft play zone will be officially open to the public. Located at Lighthouse Community Church in Sheringham, the free play space is the only facility of its kind in the town and aims to serve families as part of the church's wider community outreach. Project manager Chris Harrison said, "Despite some challenges along the way, all the funds needed to complete this project, including all the fitting out, has been provided. It is clear that God has been blessing this venture. We are particularly grateful to the contractors, Over Mills, who have been so cooperative, efficient and friendly. We are also thankful for all the help given by the architects, Chaplain Farrant, and the civil engineers, Canhams. Big thanks must also go to those who have donated funds, as we could not have achieved all this without you." The expansion was prompted by the popularity of the original play area, which reached capacity by the end of 2022. Plans for an extension were drawn up in 2023, and work began in the autumn of 2025 after receiving council approval. The project was completed in January at a total cost of around £140,000. The upgraded facility features additional play pods, a sensory play corner, and refreshed interiors. The sensory area was installed in the spring. Maggie Roth, cafe manager, said, "We see Lighthouse Cafe and soft play area alongside our threadbare shop selling pre-loved children's clothes and toys as providing vital outreach into our local community. We intend to continue to provide this enhanced soft play facility free of charge for Lighthouse Cafe customers." The opening ceremony will take place on Saturday, June the 6th, with guests invited to view the space from 10:30 a.m. to 12 p.m. Lighthouse Cafe and the Threadbare Shop are open Tuesday to Friday from 10:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m.
An artist has embarked on a major project to showcase businesses in a Norfolk town. A 59-year-old artist under the pseudonym of Pierre Cromer has brought the tradition of caricature art to Cromer and has revealed his ambitious mission for the summer. He hopes to create portraits of every shop owner in the town by the season's end and has already begun with portraits of mini cab drivers, fishmongers and many others. "It has been an amazing thing to bring people together, and I hope to highlight the local businesses," he said. "It was nice to discover, and it does make me laugh as well." The portraits, which have been completed, include John and Laura Davies from Davies Fish Shop, a family-run business in Cromer. The artist, who has lived in the town for the past 4 years, was inspired by a trip to London earlier this year. While he was walking around Leicester Square, he noticed several caricature artists with queues of people all eager for their own portraits to be done. And even though he has been creating art since he was a child, this was one form he had not yet explored. He said, "I taught myself how to do it and just keep pushing myself." All of his work is done by hand, and he hopes to do an exhibition at the end of the summer with all the portraits together. He is working in a studio at Furniture Fair, but is open to covering events as well. His project comes as the town is also gearing up to celebrate the pier's 125th anniversary this summer with a wide range of events planned in the area. Caricature portraits are a form of art which modifies or exaggerates particular features for a humorous or satirical effect and has been linked back to the Renaissance period.
Dozens of scarecrows were dotted around a village to celebrate the return of an annual festival. Wyton Scarecrow Festival in Wyton has become a popular tradition since its launch in 1999. It involves local residents decorating their gardens, homes, benches and more with lifelike displays. This year's festival kicked off on Friday and continued over the bank holiday weekend. The event featured a range of activities including a scarecrow trail, family treasure hunt, bingo night and a children's scarecrow making competition. Among the designs were a spaceman, a fisherman and a magician, with a tribute to David Attenborough's 100th birthday highlighted as a standout. A statement from organisers Wyton Village Hall said, "Despite the baking heat, we still had lots of fun on the common making scarecrows. Such a great family activity and lovely to see you get involved. Amazing to see the creativity that comes from a bale of straw and a pile of clothes. Some just liked playing in the straw, and that's great too. Thank you to everyone who came."
Old clothes belonging to Slimmers have helped raise funds for vital cancer research through a nationwide charity drive. Slimming World members in Stalham and Scratby collected 181 bags of clothing as part of the Big Slimming World Clothes Throw, raising more than £6,000 for Cancer Research UK. The donations came from members who have slimmed into smaller sizes and wanted to give back to a good cause. Dina Ball, Stalham Slimming World consultant, said, "It's always a pleasure to see the excitement in a group when the Big Slimming World Clothes Throw comes around. When you're losing weight, it can be easy to focus on the number on the scales without realising how many non-scale victories are happening in the background, like our changing dress sizes and body shapes. This event celebrates those victories as it is all about members donating their old wardrobe while raising money for an important cause. It makes me so happy to see the confidence in my members as they commit to donating their larger clothes, knowing they will never need them again because they've made healthy changes they can maintain for life." The annual campaign sees Slimming World members across the UK donate clothes, shoes and accessories they no longer fit into, all in support of Cancer Research UK shops. As well as raising funds, the campaign raises awareness of the link between obesity and cancer. Ms. Ball said, "Being overweight doesn't necessarily mean that a person will develop cancer, but we know that losing weight and maintaining a healthy weight can help prevent a number of health conditions, including some types of cancer. I'm proud to host the Big Slimming World Clothes Throw at my Slimming World group to help Cancer Research UK continue its vital work. Slimming World has raised more than £30 million for Cancer Research UK to date through various campaigns."
A children's reading scheme is set to launch with free activities, books and author visits. The Holt Bookshop has partnered with the Holt Youth Project to launch the programme, thanks to a major grant from Penguin Random Houses UK through its Penguin Children's Bookshop grant. REX Read, Examine, Explore will offer a hands-on creative approach to reading for children aged 5 to 11, targeting both eager readers and those who are less confident. Pam Horrocks and Keith Britton, owners of the Holt Bookshop, said, "We are absolutely delighted to receive this funding." Penguin Random House praised our application, saying it stood out as one that would have a genuine and meaningful impact on reading for pleasure among young people. "As a small independent bookshop, we work hard to play an active role in our community, but a programme of this kind would not be possible without external support. Free activities are especially valuable for families. They support parents, help children discover the joy of books and encourage a positive, lasting relationship with reading. Our ambition is for REX to become a legacy project. This initial grant will act as a springboard, helping us build interest, attract sponsorship, and develop long-term partnerships so the scheme can continue in future years. The £150,000 grant scheme supports independent bookshops during the National Year of Reading and is aimed at promoting reading for pleasure among children and young people. The programme will include crafts, performance, storytelling and themed creative sessions linked to the books being read. Each child will receive free books and merchandise, with special events and author visits also planned. Older members of the Holt Youth Project will be invited to mentor younger participants, helping them gain confidence and enjoyment in reading. The scheme aims to become a lasting community initiative, involving families, schools, businesses and volunteers in the Holt area.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, our liaison officer is Imogen Waterson on 01263 587 610. If you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker to listen using the talking newspaper skill. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk. But please, when returning the pouch and memory stick, do remember to reverse the label. The sound engineer this week was David Mitchell, and the editor-producer was David Audley. And our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in thanking you for listening and wishing you a week to remember. And we look forward to joining you again next Friday. But for now, though, from today's readers, it's cheerio.